I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf, and in this bonus episode, we are going to pull back the curtain and reveal the top 10 most downloaded shows of 2021. When we wrap up, we are also going to give you our producer's picks as well. I said we, so I'm thrilled to have on my friend Bruce Reed to guide this conversation. Bruce is the CFO for St. Louis-based PracticeLink, with another location in West Virginia, and I'm anxious to get his perspective on some of these shows as well. The top 10 episodes of 2021 on CFO Bookshelf, that is coming up next. Bruce, do you remember the first time we met?
Yes, I do. Clayton, Missouri.
Downtown, it was frigid cold, and I believe your boss had gone up, got up, went to the restroom, and you remember the question I asked you?
Yeah, he asked me what I was reading.
And I thought, okay, he's hired. I just went through about 30 resumes. I had interviews with some other people. I almost used a word that I'm glad I didn't say out loud, but I thought, this is it. That answer, believe it or not, that answer is like, he's hired. I didn't even need to go through the rest of the interview. By the way, there's one other thing that's very memorable about that lunch. So remember, it was cold that day, and we have to give our coats. I did not want to give up my coat. I want to keep wearing it in that restaurant. So I give away my coat. I got a number for my coat, and it had the number 42. Now, for people who live outside of the United States, 42, that's Jackie Robinson. So I took a picture of it, shared it with friends. I loved that lunch. That was a good one. I'm going to ask the question again. What are you reading, Bruce?
I've been kind of venturing out of the business book realm. I'm listening to a book by Deepak Chopra, Ageless Mind or Ageless Body, Timeless Mind. It's kind of a little bit of a change of pace, looking into rejuvenation after the beginning of the year and those sort of things. I've also been listening to a couple of books that are written by a guy that was a bouncer in the UK. He was like one of these premier bouncers, and he's got different stories. And it's interesting because, while there's the action involved, a lot of it is just about humans and behavior and those sort of things. So I find those, that kind of connection, and you can learn something from anything you read or listen to. So how about you?
I'm going through, in fact, we're going to do a show about this in a few weeks. I'm listening or reading books I've read in the past, books that are worth rereading a second time. And right now I'm reading the book Smart Growth by Edward Hess. He's been on the show over a year ago, and it is the best book ever written on growth in a business. He attacks the grow or die mantra in business. It is fantastic. I'm reading another book I'm holding in my hands right now. He is from Kansas City, Missouri. He's the founder of TradeBot and Bats. Self-made billionaire, again, from Kansas City, Missouri. The name of the book is Make the Trade. It is outstanding. And I have some friends who are friends of him, and I'm going to make a trade bet that he will be on the show later this summer. He's very humble, but yet he wrote a book because he wanted a book for his kids to be able to read down the road, family. So it's remarkable. And I'm reading about three other books, but those are the two most important ones right now.
All right. Those are two good ones.
I'm going to be turning the steering wheel over to you, or we're going to switch seats. I'm thrilled about this particular episode. We're going to look at the top 10 shows of CFO Bookshelf for 2021. And I think it is a fact that it's hard to get a handle on good data. So our podcast host does have the number of downloads, but I don't know if people are listening to 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I also don't know what dictates a download. if they listen to it for 5 seconds, does our host count it? I don't know. So we're just going by just numbers, which may be imperfect. But I'll say this, the 10 that are listed here, no surprises, none right. whatsoever. So we're going to do the top 10. We'll start with 10 and work our way upward. And BR, Bruce Reed, the Broctor, as sometimes I call you behind your back, you probably hate that term, but Bruce, why don't you just take over and start asking me questions?
All right. So at number 10, we had Danielle Martins. She's a global FP&A director. I listened to this one and was definitely found her, you know, so engaging, so likable there. And it seemed like she, you and her seemed to really click. And, you know, and also I think you got into a little bit of the importance of personality and some of those things that she saw. So what was, you know, how did that part of the conversation go?
Well, I was going to add to that real quickly. She's a person who needs to be up on a stage speaking to an audience. That was remarkable. When I asked Danielle to do the show, I found her, I think just by accident on LinkedIn. I think she was tagged. I mean, we were not connected, but someone I am connected to in the FP&A world, I saw one of her responses. I thought, there's some wisdom behind this individual. And I'm going to get to your question. But when I gave her my interview arc, and it's something I really enjoy putting together, I don't think she was expecting part of the line of questions. She's probably thinking we're going to just talk tech stuff, you know, the yeah. analytical stuff. So my favorite part, Bruce, is really getting into the people aspect and even some of the methods. And one of the concepts we talked about was the beginner's mind. So she, I just thought, nailed it because she is a people-centric leader. I mean, she's very conscientious of the people she's serving, her team. I bet her team loves working with her. And I am looking forward to following up with her. It'd be fun to have her back on the show. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. That's I thought she, you know, she took the conversation so far beyond nuts and bolts there. And I think one of the things didn't she also get into the topic of, you know, that FP&A were pretty good at the F and the P. But the A can be a challenge.
It can be a challenge. Absolutely. And again, great. So I would just recommend just key in Danielle Martins or FP&A, wherever you listen and find her. I think we did that back in the spring, but that conversation, that's still in my notes about the A part. So great perception. So Danielle, again, fantastic conversation that we had. With her. No one's going to have heard of this next person, number 9.
Jess Helvick, and he's the author of Nuts and Bolts of ESOPs for CFOs. Again, pretty consistent through this whole list. You know, just sounded like a really great guy. You know, it's nice to always hear the interactions that you and the guests have. But the guests are always so giving with their time. And he was another one of those that really, you know, for such a, what could be just a dry actuarial type topic, it was like, oh, that is such an interesting perspective on thing and a special guy to be able to take it the direction he did. What was, what sent you down the path to bring him on? What's, you know, what are some of the noteworthy things from that interview?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you asked the question, how did I find him? Or I was in a monthly financial huddle, which, by the way, I got to ask this question to a favorite CFO, my favorite CFO. Do you like the name or the term financial huddles?
I do.
Come on, Bruce, work with me.
No.
Yes.
No, they stink.
Okay, thank you.
One of the dumbest concepts.
My second favorite CFO wears a t-shirt called financial, or no, it says, do you want to huddle? because he's the guy who leads this particular financial huddle. And it's like, I want to say, Trevor, I want you to get a t-shirt just like that. Have the huddle. Do you want it? Same thing. Do you want a huddle? And then have a line drawn through the H. And then under the H, have a C. You know, do you want a cuddle? That's why I don't like huddles. So I call them financial debriefs. So in my business, in my practice, we never use the term financial huddles. They're debriefs. It just sounds more cool. Sounds more James Bond-ish. But he spoke at a financial debrief. Notice I said debrief.
No. Yes.
And he nailed it. He spoke clear. And I know my way. I know my way around ESOPs a little bit. I'm on a board that's employee owned. So I understand the language. I know some people who are just great spokespeople in the ESOP world. Jen Briggs, who I know listens occasionally, who used to be the former HR director at New Belgium. So I'm listening. It's like, I was actually taking notes, Bruce. And so I thought, you know what? He's on. So I reached out to him, thanks to my second favorite CFO. And so we just went down the what, why, and who of ESOPs. ESOPs are not for everybody. And I also like the concept of we talked about day zero and then day one of the ESOP. And so tried to make it an interesting conversation. And we did not get into the nitty-gritty details. This could have easily been called the nuts and bolts of ESOPs for CEOs.
Yeah, I'd say that was I think that's an accurate way to describe it, because it was an easy listen. And I felt like I was more informed, and I certainly knew that there was more to learn, but it was definitely an easy listen on a topic that I said somebody could take that and make it not a lot of fun to listen to.
I'm going to have you take us to the next number 8.
Number eight is Gary Harbst, and he's the author of On Strategy and Execution. Lot to dig into here, Mark. What was what really stuck out to you as one of the highlights of that one?
Can I ask you first? Have you ever heard of Gary? Had you heard of Gary Harbst before?
Outside of you mentioning, I had not.
So we called the episode Gary Harbst on Strategy and Execution. I came across his book. Maybe I'm not a good gauge of time, about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. His book is Six Disciplines.
Oh, yes.
And I came very close to joining their organization as a strategic partner. And Gary and I, at that time, we spent about 2 hours together on the phone through GoToMeeting. You remember GoToMeeting? We're in a Zoom world. And I'll never forget Gary, just a humble, generous individual, but his book, Six Disciplines. Now, I would say it's very well defined recipe approach to both strategy and execution. But the conversation I would still say this conversation, if a CEO is listening to it, it flowed. But Gary's the co-founder of Solomon Software. And he was growing that ERP solution at a time where they just did not have a lot of money, a lot of resources, a lot of employees. The not quite 800-pound gorilla at the time was Great Plains Software, which was founded by Doug Burgum, who's now a governor. And I always get it mixed up. Is it North Dakota or South Dakota? But their organization was several times bigger at the time. I think Great Plains got sold to Microsoft before Solomon did. So the bottom line is Gary, it's a big deal because he is one of the co-founders of one of the top ERP systems in the 1990s, late 80s. And so when he talks strategy, you're going to listen. And we brought up some really interesting concepts, VFOs, and then embracing constraints were two of my favorite topics. VFOs, I'm going to just throw out the term vital, few objectives, VFOs. What's the first idea that just popped into your head, Bruce?
Few is the thing that immediately sticks out. There, it's you know, and then quick, you know, quickly followed by vital. There, it's, you know, I guess, you know, not overloading, not over focusing on too many things, but really having that, being honing in on what are going to be the highest impact things to take a look at.
And when you listen to him, it's been years since I've had a grandfather that I could talk to. And unfortunately, I lost mine at a very young age. But for those of y'all who have those elderly, just full of wisdom type people, I'm not trying to say Gary's this old guy, but when you listen to him, he's just full of wisdom. And it's like, you just keep talking, Gary, and let me keep taking notes. So just a wonderful conversation with Gary Harps. Number seven, Bruce.
Number seven, we got Guy Spear and the Education of a Value Investor.
Now, this one is interesting. We need to skip our conversation about Guy because he's the only person on this list that shows up twice.
How about that?
Do you know why that is?
I don't.
Well, we'll share the rest of the story after we talk about number six. I'll just say that when we got done recording, I'm thinking, oh, no. No one's going to listen to a 2.5 hour podcast. So, I mean, I just had to not think about this interview for a couple of days, and then I figured it out what we're going to do. So Guy Spear's interview is both number seven and number five. And let's just pause on Guy because we'll talk about him at number five when we get there. Is that fine with you, sir?
Yeah, that works. That works. So let's move on to number six. And we got Dr. Edwin Locke. Dr. Edwin Locke, best known for the theory of goal setting. More about goals.
Were you, again, I'm curious about this. Are you aware of Locke? And I think his partner is Latham, Gary Latham. They're the two who did that theory of goal setting going back, maybe back in the 1960s. I'd have to redouble check the date. I know we have a lot of analytical people who are data fact finders. They'll check me on that if needed. But were you aware of the name Edwin Locke?
That's a name that rings a bell. Again, I don't know if that, you know, you bring so many of these folks to the table when we have our talks that I think that's a name that's a name that I am familiar with in the area of goal setting and getting things done. I think before you and I even met.
His name became more meaningful to me. I read his book, The Prime Movers. Again, I don't know how long for me in this world that we live in books. 8 years ago is a long time ago. It's maybe been close pushing 10 years ago that I read his book, The Prime Movers. The Prime Movers, you know, it's not a fast read. Think Jim Collins, Good to Great. In my opinion, Jim Collins, that's a marketing book because he has all these cool stories, these cool sticky terms. Dr. Locke's book is as good. It just doesn't have all the cool sticky terms. So there are a lot of concepts that you read in Good to Great. I think he goes a little bit deeper in his book, The Prime Movers. It's 10 attributes of great leaders. So I read that book and then I'm a guy who wants to dig a little bit deeper. Oh, this is the guy who did all the writing on goal setting. So I think a lot of people pull out the concept of SMART goals because of his research. Now, let me ask you this question, and don't feel guilty if you didn't listen to the show. When I asked him, when you hear the term SMART goals, you want to take a guess at what he said?
I did listen to it. I think he pushed back a little bit on SMART goals. He didn't jump straight into it. He said it was basically, you know, that's not the whole picture. SMART goals are really just, it's a very, you know, very quick, small thing.
This is a G-rated show, right? Now with you on, it may be pushing PG-13.
We'll give it a shot.
But he used the term quickie, but he said they're incomplete. So I'll just let anyone use their imagination on that one. There are two things he brought up in the theory of goal. And by the way, this is in the theory of goal setting. And this will be in the show notes if you want to read the white paper. The white paper is actually very readable. He talked about the element of difficulty. And I think in SMART goals, you really don't address that level of difficulty. He says there needs to be challenge there. I mean, they still need to be achievable, but they need to be hard. Mm-hmm. As a athlete yourself, you also weightlift. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, there needs to be, for them to really engage and to get the most out. It can't be something that's just it can't be something that's just so easily achieved that it doesn't drive for optimal performance.
I know you're anchoring this conversation, but I need to let me ask you another question.
Alrighty.
In your company, do your goals have a code of ethics? Ooh.
We'll be right back. Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Ooh, I got you.
I wouldn't say that there's not specifically stated. Now I'm gonna stand my ground and say, because of the people that we bring into the company and for the person that has founded and owns the company, there's a high level of ethics in everything we do. As far as the firmest, you know, the strict definition of it, you know, I don't know that that's not a term that we use or that we talk about.
And I you're saying something, you're implying something implied. Mm-hmm. But the reason it came up is I was asking about the dark side of goal setting.
Yes.
And what company? What company comes to mind when you think of the dark side?
Enron.
Yes.
Enron, Health South.
Wells Fargo.
I'll say, I have experienced the dark side of goals. In overseeing a bill collections department, you can see the dark side of goals in that type of work.
We're talking a big organization of mm-hmm. right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a Fortune, you know, insert numbers here, size company. Yeah.
I just want to make that clear just because it resonates, and I can understand where the goals could go a little bit too far. And by the way, we are goal-centric people. We're not saying we hate goals, but I think one of the better questions to ask is, could there be unintended consequences mm-hmm. of achieving this goal? And then answer those questions. So do there need to be some guardrails with this particular goal? That could be one way to look at. So again, you and I are not saying don't have goals, far from it. So
Yeah, I think that, and actually, you, I think you and I even touched on it a little bit when we talked about Atomic Habits a little while back.
Yes.
That, you know, that in setting some of those goals, there's ways to achieve, there's the right ways to achieve things you want to do, and there's the wrong way to achieve those things. And then it's, you know, seeing that concept, you know, hearing that concept repeated again was pretty cool. I really enjoyed listening. I liked this one because there was so much in it there. And I can't believe I couldn't, the code of ethics was one that had really stuck out.
He brought up another concept, and this is not in the SMART goals framework, and it's the concept of fractal goals. Now, I think I'm using the word fractal, but he talks about long and short-term goals. So when you set a long-term goal, you can't always see, you can't see that finish line.
Right.
So where the fractalness, I don't think there's a word, fractalness, fractality, I don't think that's a word either, but fractal goals is, let's say you're going to the sun, you're going to break that up into parts and pieces. And then as long as you can see those finish lines ahead of you, now we get to the next milestone. And that was illuminating. It was also validating to hear him talk. And that part is not in the SMART goals. One of the problems with SMART goals is they're typically short-term in nature within a year. And it's like, we need to be thinking 5 to 10 years out because that's where your risk is in terms of competition. So interesting conversation, delineating between short and long-term goals.
Yeah.
Anyway, we could go on, and I'm glad you enjoyed that. I just felt very lucky and blessed to have gotten to chat with him. I want to say I just asked him, you're not supposed to ask people their age. I think once you get over like 80, you can ask that question. So I just said, Dr. Locke, how old are you? He either said 81 or 82. Didn't bat an eye. And so, man, it just, what an honor.
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to that one. He was, he was somebody enjoyable to listen to. And I thought I got a lot out of that one. All right, we're at number 5. And this is, we are back to Guy Spear.
So here's the story. You want to hear the story on how I got introduced to Guy?
Got to hear the story. If you went 2+ hours, I got to know, I got to hear it all.
Well, I had already interviewed Adam Mead, and he's up in number, he's in the 4 hole, the 4 slot. Mm-hmm. He's cleanup hitter. That's baseball fans. We have UK listeners, and I know cricket is this one of the sports there beyond their version of football and rugby. By the way, we need to have a rugby conversation. That's one sport I would never play. I would not play that for all the tea and I want to keep my teeth.
And you see those guys too. That is a thick muscular bunch.
Yeah, I want to eat what they're eating. So Adam, we have to talk a little bit about Adam because his book has a blurb with Guy Spear's name on it. And I'm thinking, Guy is one of my, I have 3 books that are story driven that in my opinion are the best value investor books ever. Again, that are story driven. His is one of them. The Education of a Value Investor. Number 2 is The Dondo Investor. And then number 3 is 100 Baggers. I love those 3 books. Probably Guy's is the one I like the most, but I read that one first of those 3. So I already love the book. And so Adam is like, Adam, can you make an introduction? So it's actually a few weeks later, I get an email from Guy who says, hey, let's do this. So it was in the evening. He's in the UK. Or actually, no, he's where is he? Of course, after the show, I'll remember exactly where he is. It's not UK, but he's on the other side of the pond, at least from a US perspective. And the reason we had to go 2 hours or 2.5 hours is because he took his time. We talked, by the way, that's not counting the time we talked before and after. I just felt like I gained a friend. This was a phenomenal book. If you like value investing, you know what? If you don't like value, if you're a financial leader, you're going to learn from this book. So the way I found him was thanks to Adam. I was already a fan. He has a big following globally. So his book is part memoir. He gets into some of the mistakes he made after he graduated from a very prestigious college. And I think if he had his, if he could do a do-over, there might be. And then he starts his own investing mm-hmm. firm, thanks to the backing and encouragement of his father.
Well, encouragement of his father, it was a little bit more than that.
Yeah,
if I recall correctly.
Yeah. It was more than a nudge, but right. It was the kind of words to where, boy, he believes in me. He's also, and still is, managing his father's money. And you may think, oh, yeah, that's easy. Uh-uh. How would you like to be in charge of managing?
Oh, no. Heck, no. No, I would not. Well, the other thing I liked about him, too, is he did get help from his dad. He got financial help from his dad, and he makes no bones about it. He's not trying to
right.
Pretend like he was a pull it up from the bootstraps. They just kicked me out when I was 15. I had to make it on my own. He was very transparent. He got some financial help from his dad to get started. He also made the point that there's people who get billions of dollars of support that go bust. So he's taking the credit where credit's due, but I thought he was, I liked his approach a lot.
I have many one-to-one meetings with CEOs in my practice, and maybe this happens with every consultant, Bruce, mm-hmm. but I've had my own clients say, can I have one of my other peers sit in on one of our meetings? And it's like, well, yeah. It's a little bizarre, but even this week it happened again. And that other peer said, can you do something like us with that you're doing with this company? And the reason I bring that up is because a lot of my education has come from reading and studying investors. I feel like if you want to be a great financial analyst, read and study the people who are like Warren Buffett. Mm-hmm. Read the people who are like Warren Buffett that no one knows them, who are great writers, and they just help you to think analytically and maybe think differently. And that's why I love books like his. We hit temperament versus IQ. We hit on checklists. That part was really cool in the book. We talked about momentum versus value investing. Now, I threw that in. That's not in the book. And then we had a lightning round, which we hit like 10 topics, like boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. And that was fun. The reason we had to break this up into two shows was it was so long. So episode number 7, which is, I called it The Education of a Value Investor, that was more about the book. And this particular episode was called A Virtual Dinner with Guy Spier. I don't know if anyone, you'd have to read the book to understand that title, because him and his friend, one of his friends, won a dinner to have a dinner with Warren Buffett. And so that's why, we did a little engineering on this show. We pulled out the parts where it was just very extremely conversational, to where it almost sounded like we were at dinner. We just didn't have the restaurant ambiance. But that episode was number 5, and that turned out to be the 5th most downloaded show of 2021. And by the way, great guy. I hope to meet him at the Woodstock for Capitalists later this year. That would be the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting.
And I think that's a nice segue into into Adam Mead and the complete history of Berkshire Hathaway. Speaking of Warren Buffett.
When you hear
Charlie Munger in some of the cases. So
when you hear the term acolyte, what does that name? What does acolyte mean to you?
Well, Well, you know, you and I both we spent some time talking about the book Boyd.
Yes.
So it's, I mean, I consider that to be in its simplest terms, a devoted follower and and somebody who not only is following the person, but has really committed themselves and is really bought into somebody's ideas, somebody's methods, everything about them, everything about a topic, everything about a cause, that person is all in.
This book is called The Complete History of Berkshire Hathaway. The key word here is complete. It is complete. In fact, this morning I picked up, it's one of the books I don't have actually in the bookshelf. It's on a shelf so I can reach to it and pull it out anytime I want to. Now, I have not read it from cover to cover. I'll pick topics or investments, and it's maybe 10, 15 pages, roughly. It's an interesting read. Complete is a good name for that book. It has 775 pages once you get past the index. So 5 years of research on this book. And Adam is an advanced financial advisor. That's his day job. And he knocked it out of the ballpark, but kudos to him for devoting 5 years. And this is a book that will have a very long shelf life. I'm a Robert Hagstrom fan. He's my favorite author of anyone who writes about Buffett. But this one, if you just want a list and some of the history of each investment from the beginning, this is the definitive book. There'll never be a book written like this. In fact, this book will probably be a go-to book for researchers, if not already. It's phenomenal. His output, the product, I'm still astounded at how he pulled it off.
Well, I think you said, or even covered in the discussion, that, you know, a great book, fascinating, but the academic application of this book is there's a high potential for that as well.
I asked him that question, and of course, I put him on the spot. He's humble, but I asked him, why wouldn't this book be a great text for any MBA program? And again, I just know his answer was good. It was not a self-serving answer when he came back. But I'm just in awe. There are over 200 books, at least 200 books that are, I would say, just decent reads about Buffett or Berkshire Hathaway, more than 200. I don't know if that's as many as on the Titanic, maybe a fraction, but again, a lot of books. This one's going to be around. I just want to mention one more thing. I did ask him, and this needs to be a tease. I can't give away everything, but I did ask him his favorite investment. And I'm glad I did, because I would have never guessed it. So it made me go back and read his favorite investment. I'll just say at the time, it was a mini conglomerate. And it was not, Buffett did not write a check out of petty cash for this particular investment. So we'll just leave that as a tease. Look up Adam Mead on CFO Bookshelf, wherever you listen to this podcast. It's a very, very good conversation. Nothing dull about it whatsoever.
All right, moving along. We're up to number three. We're getting on the medal stand here. Jack McCullough. Well, yeah, I love, this is a great one. What is a rock star CFO?
This one, I'm telling you, Bruce, you've got some competition. There's this budding bromance that's developing. Maybe it's one-sided between Jack and I. A common friend said, you need to interview Jack. And because I work in the consulting space versus the W-2 space, if I were a W-2 CFO, I would had already known Jack. But I think just because of the world I live in, I'd not come across Jack. And one of our common friends said, you really need to interview him. So I read his book, What is a Rockstar CFO? And I thought, okay, I'll go interview Jack McCullough. So number three, and just I was blown away. We've now have had multiple conversations through email. We have another show coming up with him on his second book. And he has 10 traits of a rockstar CFO. And I asked him up front, can we go back and forth? Can you talk about a trait? And then you asked me about a trait. And I thought that made it more interesting because I had some strong opinions. I didn't disagree with any of his traits, but I had some strong opinions on several of them. But I just want to say something, Bruce. In my opinion, he had the greatest, best comment I've ever heard on CFO Bookshelf. We are talking about ethics. Here it is.
Before I got married, my wife and I are Catholic, and we went to this thing called Pre-Cana. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's sort of counseling for married couples. And, you know, to be honest, I didn't pay that. I didn't get that much from all of it. I'll admit I was doing it for my wife. But there was one line that the priest said, which has stuck with me throughout. And he said, when's the most difficult time to commit adultery? The first. And the point is, once you've made an ethical compromise, it's really easy to make the second and the third and the fourth.
Yes. When I was listening to this, that was the point where, you know, you're sitting listening to a podcast, you may be, you know, looking out the window or doing whatever. And that was like the lock in yes moment. And, you know, I think for a CFO, for anybody who is the custodian of ethics for an organization, that is a line that should be in a plaque or on a piece of paper and tacked to the wall.
He nailed it. I was listening to it again. That was cut out for me by one of our intern support people. And I was listening to it. I hit it again and again. And I thought, this is remarkable. Absolutely. Yeah. He nailed it. But that was a fun show. He made one of his quotes. I remember pulled out another quote. Don't just record history. Make history. Are you making history in your company, Bruce?
Yeah. It's with the, you know, being in the, having the good fortune to be in the size organization that we are, and particularly how we're structured right now and how we're going about our business, we're all getting involved in the business beyond just, being the record keeper, being the bookkeeper in my case, and, you know, and many others in their cases as well.
We're getting down to the wire here.
Yeah, this is starting to get neck and neck. We got Steve Wexler, and this is a conversation about data viz, one of our favorite topics.
Steve, I don't know how well known he is outside of his space. Anyone that works deeply in the Tableau, by the way, talking of acolytes, Tableau acolytes, they're mm-hmm. going to know who Steve is. In fact, I'm going to be attending one of Steve's two-day workshops on dashboards, and I cannot wait. It's going to be in early February. Steve is the co-author. The first book he has his name on is The Big Book of Dashboards. And I, by the way, I got that book. I pre-ordered it. I knew when it was coming out. I'm a big fan of one of his co-authors, Andy Cotgreave, who will probably be on the show later in the year. But Steve, I'd forgot he was a co-author on that. And then just this past year, is either this year or the year before, he came out with his own book with just him as the author. It's The Big Picture. It's The Big Picture. And it's good. I mean, I have every Stephen Few book. I have Tufte's book. I mean, I've probably have close to 50 or 60 books just on data viz in my library, and many of them going back years. But this book is just, it's foundational and it's good. I even think a business leader could pull this out and get value out of it. But a topic I never get tired of talking about is pre-attentive attributes. And I think I have learned that any person like Steve, a teacher of data viz, that's one of the first things they talk about, the concept of pre-attentive attributes. So I get to sound like I'm a professor or a teacher. What is that?
I was hoping you'd tell me what a pre-attentive attribute.
Well, here's the thing. You know what they are. You just didn't know the name attached to this idea or concept. Mm-hmm. Imagine a 3x3 grid of dots. No grid, just 9 dots. So 3, 3, 3, another okay. row. And let's say they're all black and they're all the same size. Now let's take that same 9 dots and let's make one of them red and a little bit bigger. Where does your eyeball go to?
Big red dot, baby.
The big red dot, baby. Let's take some toothpicks. All the toothpicks are the same. They don't stand out, do they?
No.
Now you take those same toothpicks and one's about half the size. Which one do you see first?
The one that's about half the size.
Pre-attentive attributes. I think when in the United States, the elections every 4 years where they have the blue states, red states, then you got gray states. They have not been won yet. But the ones that pop, the red, that's a pre-attentive attribute, or the blue is a pre-attentive attribute. So it's taking data and doing something to where you are going to notice it. And that was just a fun conversation. It's such a great way to talk about the benefits of data viz. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And first I got to give you credit for, I give you credit that a conversation on data viz didn't end up going 4 hours, because I know if that's a topic you can nerd out on. And So hats off to you for keeping it short. And I think the other thing that was the one thing, and probably on that, roughly that same topic, the item about too many colors, and red, yellow, green.
You nailed it.
I think people got to get into that red, yellow, green discussion, because that was important for two things. One, kind of overplayed and maybe doesn't make sense everywhere. The second is there's a large percentage of the population that is colorblind, and those color combinations aren't working for that part of the population. And that was kind of an eye opener to me as well.
You know, I've been lucky on some of these guests. None of these people that I talk to are into themselves. They're not narcissistic. They're not ego. Well, everyone has ego, but Steve, just what a great conversationalist he is. So if you've not heard that show, I highly encourage you. Heck, I don't care if you go to YouTube and find Steve on YouTube, you just find him talking about some general topic on data viz. So
yeah,
I
feel like he was somebody that if I had a viz that I wanted somebody to critique, I would feel very comfortable giving it to him, because he would make me feel like a complete idiot for what I'd done. It just, he gave that impression that it's all about doing good. It's not about that. It's not about him.
And there is
a good dude.
There is a science to data viz, but he also understands the art. So he's not going to critique people who are focusing somewhat on the art side of data viz. He's not that dogmatic. I mean, it's like, who is your customer as you're creating these data vizes that you want to share with your customers, your readers. So like I said, he's balanced. He's there. I'm not going to name his name, but there's one guy, I think he's kind of semi-retired. I would not want to have him on, because I think he's too dogmatic. And if I were his image consultant, I'd say, you got to tone it down. And I've had people behind his back say, you're right. We're not going to name names. Any DataViz people who are listening, they know exactly who I'm talking about. So, well, okay, you got one more on your list, looks
all
like.
All right, and coming in at number one is Gilbert Eichelenboom.
Oh, you got that name right.
Hey, it's, yeah, it's just like it's spelled. And
yeah, right.
That was a conversation about people skills for analytic thinkers.
That is one of those books you probably get an Amazon email message every day or every other day. Seems like I get three or four a day, but they'll say, Mark, we think you might like this book. So there's luck involved because a lot of times I'll hit delete, 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 delete. But I happened to see the title in my overflow folder and I saw the title. It said People Skills for Analytical Thinkers. Click, buy. And it's like, I want to read this. I didn't have time to read it right away, but once I did, got into it, it flowed. And I just thought, my first thought, Bruce, was I wish I'd had this book 25 years ago. Because I'm one of those people that was forced to go to charm school early in my career. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much told, yeah, you're a keeper, but you need to not be as intense. And I did share that on the show.
Yeah.
And I told Gilbert that, yeah, this is a book that you shouldn't be reading this in your 20s. You should be reading this book in your teens. And he appreciated that compliment. This is a good concept. It's based on some other research. He shares his knowledge in a very simple, compelling, memorable manner and method. It's sticky. And I just thought this is a good book. It's probably a book I will even revisit again. We live in the world of everybody should write a book and then go become a consultant. So you and I both have a little bit of we're a little bit jaded here when it comes to, yeah. What's the agenda here? But I really, truly believe Gilbert, I mean, he believes he would write this book, even if it didn't mean he'd be doing any speaking appearances or any consulting related to this. He truly, but he probably wrote this book as much for himself as he did for people that he knows and future people that he will know. Recommend the book. And I do have, if you have time, I'll just mention a couple of the bullet points.
Sure.
His big bullet point is that our brain is nothing but a set of algorithms. That's how we typically behave, our typical behaviors. So algorithms equals behavior. So he has a framework called input, process, output. Output is the behavior. Mm-hmm. So if you want to change your behaviors or your algorithms, you need to go back, change the inputs, and change the process, which, by the way, goes back to one of your favorite books, James Clear, Automatic Habits, right?
Right. Yeah. I saw I saw some overlap between these two books.
And he threw in some fun stuff. He talked about the Batman versus the Joker algorithm, and he talks about blind spots. And again, Gilbert knocked it out of the ballpark. Again, he's younger. I mean, of course, at my age, everyone is young. but he was so, again, gracious with his time, very humble. He's not hardcore about this. It's, you know, here it is. And I've been through this. You can get through this too. So I think anyone that is a hardcore analytical thinker, this is a book to revisit. I think if you really like the book, How to Win Friends and Influence Others, this is a good rebound book for that Dale Carnegie book.
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic because I think there's a lot of good thinking, a lot of good ideas, a lot of very talented people who get derailed really because they're not fortunate enough to have somebody like you did that said, okay, you've got this one thing that you need to work on. A lot of people are just left to flounder because they're you know, it's, and it's, and a lot of, it's because everything is so obvious to them. It's all very logical. It's all very obvious. And, you know, that should be enough. And the reality is in our world, in business world, in human interactions, just being right, having all the answers, it just isn't enough to be able to influence and to connect with people around you.
Well, that is our top 10. And I want to thank you for helping me out. And we've got a few shows in us here in the next few months that I'm going to be dragging you in to this. And we've got an interesting topic we'll be talking about next time you hear us. And I haven't told you yet.
All right. Well, I'm always up for whatever we get to talk about. I always get a lot out of it. I really appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate the opportunity to be introduced to all of these people that that you talk to on the show, the authors, the experts, and these you know, on these different things that are important to me. And the thing that makes it that nice is, like we've said a couple of times, but can't say it enough, just the quality of people who are willing to come on, willing to give their time, you know, seem to do it very, very, very readily, very, very giving. It's always a pleasure. So, Mark, I'm glad CFO Bookshelf is out there for me to enjoy. And I always enjoy the opportunity to come on and interact.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
Bruce Reed, that is the Chief Financial Officer for PracticeLink, based in St. Louis, Missouri, with an office in Hinton, West Virginia. I think he will allow me to say this. If you are a young CFO going through some potentially some people issues with your senior leadership team, the CEO you work for, maybe even internally within your own department, reach out to Bruce. Just find him on LinkedIn, and I'm sure he'd be glad to listen and provide some feedback. This guy is extremely insightful. I get to visit with him on a weekly basis, and this guy, I think the word integrity in the context of wholeness, he understands every aspect of his business, from marketing to sales to operations to customer support, as well as the support functions inside the business. And he's a people person. People around the organization look up to him. They respect him, and also within his own department. He's a people person. So reach out to him, and I'm sure he'd be more than happy to be a sounding board. Okay, you heard the top 10. I want to share some other episodes that meant a lot to me. I'm going to read these in the order they were published. So we'll start with number one, Steve Cakebread. He wrote the book, The IPO Playbook. He has taken several businesses public, one being Salesforce, his first. Just an enjoyable interview. It was the first show I've ever done where the publicist was also on the call listening. Not nerve-wracking. It was interesting. And I'll never forget, we get wrapped up. I thought I was taking up too much of Steve's time. So he leaves the call. The publicist there. She's outstanding. She says, "Mark, I think he likes you. I think he liked the interview." So I do hope to have Steve on again. The next person I want to mention and give a shout out to, Dean Spitzer. Dean is semi-retired. He wrote the book, Transforming Performance Measurement. Great show. The next show I want to mention, Howard Green. I am a huge fan of Howard Green. He's the author of Railroader, among other books. But I would have to say that was one of my favorite interviews during the year. And Howard, if you're listening, again, thank you. We need to find an excuse to bring you back on. When I wanted to launch the show, I wrote down a list of 100 names that would be guests that I initially wanted to have on the show. This next person was in my top 10, the first 10 people I wanted to reach out to. It took about a year, but she finally said yes. I am a huge Stacey Barr fan who is based in Australia. I think for those of us in the U.S., we don't hear her name that much, and that's a shame. She's written the book Practical Performance Measurement and her second one, Prove It. And just read her blog. Go to Stacey Barr, do a search. You'll find her blog. It is outstanding. She is, in my opinion, the top person in performance measurement. She's second to none. The next person close to Howard Green is David Farber. May not know the name, but he's written probably, if not my first favorite book of all time, my second, John Jacob Raskob, the first ever CFO in the modern business era. The name of the book, Everybody Ought to Be Rich. Again, enjoyable conversation. David, I can't say enough for him being on the show. So what's that other book that I really love? Well, it's called American Icon. So I reached out to Bryce Hoffman. I said, Bryce, I would love to have you on the show. And he says, Mark, can we talk about my other book? What other book? So Red Teaming. So Red Teaming is an outstanding book. If you are an analyst, business analyst, financial analyst, people analyst, it doesn't matter. You're going to love this book. It's just chock full of mental models. Red Teaming is the name of the book. But then we also talked about, of course, Alan Mulally and American Icon. The next person I feel very blessed to have gotten to talk to, Chuck Coonrod. Just like with Dr. Edwin Locke, Chuck is retired as well. And he is the grandfather of gamification, and he wrote the book, The Game of Work. He has a couple others, but that's really the book he's known for. Him and Stacey Barr, now that would be a fascinating conversation along with Dean Spitzer. And Chuck, that will be a show, an interview, a conversation I'll never forget. Charles Rosati wrote the book, Many Unhappy Returns. Charles was lulled out of semi-retirement. He may have still been working. He's chairman of the board, a publicly traded company. He's asked to come to run the IRS for 5 years. So he's a private citizen who ran a public company, and now he has to turn around the IRS, and he did it with the help of his team. By the way, he was the fourth or fifth employee for the Boston Consulting Group. He was hired directly by Bruce Henderson. So that was another one of my favorite episodes. I would also say that's, again, that is what we call one of the producer's picks. Got three more. Jeff Smith, if you are a Missourian, you may have heard of the name Jeff Smith. He went to prison for a reason that I just find foolish. I feel like it was improper. Justice was not served in a proper manner. I think he was made an example of. Read the book called Mr. Smith Goes to Prison. There is a chapter that I'll have to admit, it was a fun read. It wasn't a fun read for him to have lived it, but there's a chapter about MBAs. And if you want to get an MBA, being in prison, you're going to learn as much more there as you will at any Ivy League business school. And that part is, it's either chapter 4 or chapter 5. And that was fun reading. Again, I cannot imagine him having to relive what he wrote. Ron Baker is one of my all-time favorite people. Ron was also in my top 10 people to interview when made the decision to launch this podcast. Now, this was his second time on. He sent me a book called Mind Over Matter, and I didn't read it at first, and then I picked it up, and this is really good. And it's a book about intellectual capital. He gets into the three capitals, and I think we spent the most time talking about human capital and social capital, not as much about structural capital. Great book. I would say it's a practical book on economics. And Ron, I know you listen and loved the show. And another, I'm trying not to laugh here. Mark Miami Paul, he is a better horse race better. If you like the Kentucky Derby, if you like horse race, I know nothing about the sport. So I picked up his book. It's called The Greatest Gambling Story Ever. They did, I guess it's called pre-betting. They bet on a horse 3 months in advance of the Kentucky Derby. And him and his friend, who is nameless in the book to protect him, they went down into Mexico to place the bet. It turns out that this racetrack was affiliated with the Mexican cartel. So the name of the book is The Greatest Gambling Story Ever Told. Fun read. If I have one criticism, and I told him this later, I wish there would have been an epilogue because I wanted to know what happened to all of these people. So it's a true story and fascinating. So those are some of my picks in addition to the top 10 you just heard. And we need to wrap this up. And all I can say is thank you for listening. And wherever you listen, if there's a place for you to hit like, please do so, especially on Apple. That means a lot to us. So drop us a line. Well, you know, what do you think? And also drop me a line on LinkedIn. I hear from people periodically, and those comments mean a lot to me as well. Hey, that's a wrap. And again, thank you for listening to CFO Bookshelf.